Now, here's a quote I saw on the internet the other day. It's talking about the possible damage from relying on the latest information technology. Quote, "This invention will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it because they will not practice their memory. That invention, not the smartphone or the internet or chatbot-assisted searches, it's writing." And that quote was from over 2,000 years ago. Our next guest says there's a long history of human anxiety about the impact of technology and access to information and how it could hurt the way we think. He traces that history in a new piece in Eon magazine. Joe Stadalnik is an independent researcher, writer, and editor. He's a scholar in residence at the Newberry Library in Chicago. I talked to him yesterday. Now, before we get to some of the specific examples you write about, it was kind of amazing to me that whether we go back 1 week or 2.5 millennia, people have been worried about being distracted by, in effect, too much information. What are some of the common themes you ran across, whatever historical period you dug into?
One of the common themes you see everywhere is this anxiety that there's way too much to read and not enough time to read it. And the effect is that people are not only losing focus, but they're focusing on the wrong things. So all the way back to the Roman philosopher Seneca, you have Seneca had a famous quote that the abundance of books is a distraction. And this is a platitude that you hear repeated over and over again in the Western tradition, but you see echoes of it in China as well. The 12th century philosopher Zhu Xi, who also complains that people are reading sloppily these days because they have way too many books at their disposal and the wrong kinds of books. So this is an old anxiety.
And the amazing thing to me is in some of the time periods we're talking about here, like if I had, 30 parchments or books, that was a pretty big library for the time. It's not like I just wonder at these people if they walked into a library today, how overwhelmed it would look to them.
Yeah, it would have been overwhelming. I think the number for, the largest libraries in the Renaissance or the early modern period would have had books probably in the thousands. And I think there are many public libraries today who have thousands of books. And back then, that would have been an astounding number.
I want to name some more names now. The oldest person you reference in the book, or the furthest back, we're talking like 2,400 years ago or so, the Greek philosopher Plato, and he shares a little story about the invention of writing and a debate, as he describes it, between two different Egyptian gods on what writing is going to do for, or I guess do to, people. What are the two sides of that debate?
Yeah, Plato is writing a dialogue, and one of the characters of the dialogue is Socrates. And I believe it's Socrates who tells the anecdote of the inventor of writing in ancient Egypt. Even to them, this was happening in the distant past. The ancient Egyptian inventor of writing goes to the king and presents his invention as a kind of miraculous thing that will extend the human memory. He says, "This invention will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memories, for it is an elixir of memory and wisdom." But the king is immediately suspicious, and he responds that this invention will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it, because they will not practice their memory. And he says that this is not a technology of memory, but of reminding. So already in ancient Greece, for Plato, this fear that the technology of writing is changing the way we think was already old.
And then another character you bring up is Petrarch. Now, he's a scholar, a poet in Italy in the late 1300s. And this is still, if I have my timing right, before the printing press is hitting Europe and having this explosion of books. And he, like some of the other people you mentioned, is already complaining that there are too many books and it's making us distracted and dumber.
Yeah, I think he's being a little, truly he's probably ambivalent. He knows that more books is probably better for the world, but he's kind of voicing these certain reservations. This was before the printing press, but it was during a time when books were becoming more manuscript books, handwritten books were becoming more abundant. And he's talking about people who have had the good fortune of owning many, many books and are collecting them. And he says that to own many books is not nourishing the mind with literature, but killing it and burying it with the weight of things.
I laugh along a little bit because so many of things you're saying from 800 years ago, 2000 years ago, like I've seen arguments like this on the internet, like over the last 2 weeks. You looked at some of the modern literature on this. This is not your specialty, I know, but as you look at some of the, you know, rip from the headline things, the same arguments still happening today as, you know, with the arrival of mass production of handwritten books?
Yeah, what I found interesting about the conversations today, a lot of them feature a writer who has decided that the phone is a problem, their laptop is a problem, and they kind of go off to the wilderness and they kind of reconnect with older media, with books, and then they come back wiser and with a new relationship to technology. And a lot of this is about, a lot of them say, a lot of them return to reading novels. And one of the things that I discuss in my essay is how novel reading and novels themselves were the dangerous technology that was breaking readers' brains in the early 19th century. We had physicians advising patients that novels produce nervous habits. They excessively stimulate the mind with their interesting and melting tales. So it was just ironic to me that, or maybe it was ironic, but also gave me a kind of different perspective on how these anxieties look from a vantage point of the future. No one worries today that novels are breaking our brains. In fact, we've gone in the complete opposite direction. And we worry that we're not reading enough novels.
We're talking to Joe Stadalnik, talking about his piece in Eon magazine titled "We've Always Been Distracted," looking at fears about information overload and new technology going back literally thousands of years. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Joe Stadalnik about his piece in Eon magazine called "We've Always Been Distracted," about the long history of worries that information technology is making us more distracted and less smart. Now, I wonder, you're somebody who studies people like Geoffrey Chaucer, the Canterbury Tales guy, among other things. Do you ever wonder, like, you know, can you connect with his brain, given that, you know, he probably had to handwrite this with these fairly scarce materials? Versus, you know, somebody in our age who might be looking things up at a computer and typing about it. Do you feel like it's hard to bridge the gap between our mind as we think and write now and a Geoffrey Chaucer type author's mind?
I think so. I think sometimes about how my own writing has developed, and I've developed a voice or a style that I think of as my own, but is in fact entirely shaped by my history as a writer writing on word processors. I remember writing on the old Macintosh SE in my house as a five-year-old, that I've always associated writing with word processing and the ability to cut and paste, to delete, to edit and re-edit and re-edit before committing to anything. And I do have a hard time imagining what it would be like in a world where you have pen and parchment is scarce, and poetry is something that is as much spoken and heard as it is written down and read. For me, that's just not been my experience. So that's one of the many gulfs that you're having to cross when trying to connect with an author who has lived 600 years ago. It's not just about what they knew or what they believed, but also how they read and wrote. And that's really what draws me to study medieval manuscripts and these kind of esoteric objects hidden away in libraries, why I think I'm so drawn to them.
Now, reading your piece and then thinking about it for the interview, I've kind of like, I started categorizing different parts of my life where I'm glad I have this reference, or there are places where you can't do it. So like, I have an address book. I'm very glad I don't have to memorize the address of every single human I know. That is a very fine use of technology. But I think of, you know, a stage actor, they have to do it the old-fashioned way, learn every single word. Or a surgeon, I really hope that they don't have to consult a lot of reference material mid-surgery. I don't know. It seems like we could compartmentalize ways in which we use technology in one way and have to really still rely on our brains in the old-fashioned way in another.
Yeah, this is the age-old problem of information management, that we have things that we'll need to know, and we're all constantly making decisions about what we're going to commit to memory and what we won't, and what kind of tools are at our disposal to store that information. And for those who are curious, there's a fantastic book by the historian Anne Blair, who describes or who collects many of the examples I've been talking about today in a history of information management, and how over the course of time we've developed different strategies to select what we need to remember and what we need to write down, how we've developed strategies to store that information, to summarize that information. And she's really interested in that history of information management. That's maybe not what we think of when we think about all the intellectual progress that one could track from the Middle Ages to now. She's sort of tracking how all that information was stored and handled in these different and innovative ways over that time. So your address book is one of the strategies that it's a physical handwritten address book, Rob?
It is, yes.
A manuscript
address book. Old-fashioned, yeah.
And that's another thing you see too, is that technologies don't just disappear when some new version becomes available. You've stuck with your manuscript address book, and other people might see it as anachronistic or old-fashioned. But these old technologies do have staying power. Like, manuscript books didn't disappear when the printing press was invented.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Joe Stadalnik, independent researcher, writer, and editor. He's a scholar in residence at the Newberry Library in Chicago. His piece in Eon Magazine, We've Always Been Distracted, is linked at wpr.org/centraltime. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Time for a little Name That Tune, Opera Edition. Alles ist der Liebe, Freundin, Schnäbel, Tendel, Herz und Küss. Und ich soll die Liebe meinen, weil ein Schwarzer hässlich ist, weil ein Schwarzer hässlich ist. If you guessed The Magic Flute by Mozart, you got it. And specifically there, we were listening to the character Monostatos, who's described as a Moor in the opera. Here's a translation of what we just heard the character saying. I've got this written down. I didn't translate this on the fly. Quote, everyone feels the joys of love. Bill and Coo flirt, snuggle, and kiss. And I am supposed to avoid love because a black is ugly. This character, this opera, are the first area of focus for a new podcast that's exploring and elevating black representation in Western classical music. Terrence McKnight is weekday evening host for WQXR, New York City's only all-classical music station. He's a commentator, curator, writer, author, and pianist as well. He's host of the new WQXR podcast called Every Voice. It launched today. Terrence, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, nice to be with you.
What was the inspiration behind this new podcast?
Well, I've had a life in music, you know. Mm-hmm. I've been involved in music since I was a kid. I got involved in church as a young person. And sort of my role as a church musician was to bring people together, you know, to bring people together in one spirit and to uplift the human spirit, give them something to, you know, latch on to for a week until they came back to church the next Sunday, give some hope. And so, you know, through my life as a musician, that's sort of been my mandate. to do just that, bring people together. And we all know, once you go into a classical concert hall, you don't see a swath of what America looks like. It's, you know, it's very sort of monolithic, and it's been that way for a long time. And so when we got this opportunity to do this podcast, I figured we should have a conversation to try to move the needle.
I understand a lot of the focus of season one of the podcast is opera in particular. Can you talk about your relationship with that that genre?
Well, I went to school for music. And so, you know, in most conservatory or college programs here in our country, if you go to school for music, you're going to deal with Western European music. That's just how it is. And so as a pianist, I did a lot of accompanying in voice studios, and the literature, the repertoire, is that from, you know, the Baroque, classical, romantic periods. So you come across a lot of this, you know, operatic literature. And, you know, once you start delving into the words, you know, I was a pianist, but, you know, you have to understand the text to know what you're accompanying. Once you start delving into the words and looking on the stages and seeing, you know, that underrepresentation, you know, it causes one to stop and perhaps, if you have time, to think about it. And in my case, working in radio and producing concerts, and now with a podcast, you know, there's an opportunity to have a conversation about it. So that was sort of my genesis, just growing up around music, studying it in college, learning the text, and having an opportunity to have a conversation about it with my audience.
You know, speaking of the text, so when I heard the short description of your podcast, I assumed, oh, this is going to be Black performers, Black composers, and that's going to be part of the story. But that Mozart clip we played there, looking at how some of the big operas represent a handful of Black characters, something I'll admit I hadn't ever really thought about. That excerpt from Magic Flute, what kind of things are you looking at in the way that someone like Mozart represented a Black character?
Well, I mean, we think about when Mozart wrote this piece, 1791, you know, you think about what was going on around the world, what was going on around the diaspora with Black folks. And, you know, so this character that Mozart writes into his opera is really just an extension of the politics and the social conduct of that time. And so he has this character, Monostatos, depicted as an enslaved man who is really just looking for love. But because he's Black, he cannot be seen. You know, he was just considered in the opera, not only is he an enslaved man, he is the butt of the joke. His desire to be loved and to be kissed and to be a part of a group is laughed at. He's the laughingstock of the opera. Not only that, but he receives a whipping. You know, he's whipped because he desires love, and that's the big joke in the opera. And another big joke is that he's so consumed with the sound of music that he forgets his pain, and he just dances off and everything is fine, and that becomes the joke. He's the laughing stock of the opera. And when I see his character, when I read about him and read his words, I have nothing but empathy for this dude. You know, there are more folks like him in our culture who feel outed, who feel othered, who feel desperate for attention, for a community, than there are princes and kings. Like, you know, that in this opera, they're the ones who walk away with the prize. You know, the prince finds the princess. And it's sort of a fairy tale, but it was a reality check for someone like Monostatos. And so that's why I wanted to tell his story, because it's relevant in our own time.
I'm no opera expert, but Magic Flute, this is a pretty big deal. What is your hope for the way a modern listener approaches this? It sounds like you're not saying, you know, well, let's stop listening to and performing Magic Flute. That said, what would you want the performers in the audience to have in mind with a character like that, or some of the other ones you talk about in your first episode of the podcast?
Yeah, well, you know, there is that contingent of folks who will say, burn it down, stop performing this stuff. You know, we need to repeal and replace. But I think there's a teaching moment here. You know, it's the music is great. The story is valid. I think there is a teaching moment here that instead of laughing at Monostatos, instead of directors creating that environment where he becomes the laughing stock, I think that the the director, the conductor, the audience can feel empathy for this character. I mean, if we understand where he's coming from, you know, this man was enslaved, so he probably never was held by his own mother. He probably never got to know his own family. And the fact that he is so desperate to be seen, to be heard, I think there are a lot of people in our culture who need that. And I think if we can give it on stage and see it on somebody on stage, then we're more likely to see it in people who are around us, who end up sometimes doing very desperate things to hurt not only themselves, but to hurt others in our community.
We're talking to Terrence McKnight from WQXR Classical Music in New York. He's the host of the new WQXR podcast called Every Voice. It launched today. You also feature some contemporary operas, including the Black composer Sharon Willis. I want to listen to a clip from her opera. It's about African-American entrepreneur Madam C.J. Walker. Performance there from the AmeriColor Opera Alliance with Sharon Willis, which Sharon Willis founded. Terrence, can you talk about this opera and how it fits into your podcast?
I can tell you about Sharon Willis. I can tell you this. When I lived in Atlanta and I would go and see her operas, man, people would be standing in line. They would be so excited. And they would, you know, there's this sort of mystique to opera that some folks don't feel, you know, that it's for them. But her operas were so relatable. The stories were so relevant. And the music, there was something in her music that was familiar. I mean, they're all in English. And so I think the point of access for most folks was very low. And people just left feeling so charged, you know, and they, when's the next production? It was like a big family reunion, man. All kinds of folks who would never step foot into the Metropolitan Opera House or a big opera house, they would come see her operas. They were small scale, and the stories were wonderful and entertaining. Yet, you know, like she tells the story of Madam C.J. Walker, we know her being the woman who founded this company to provide, you know, hair products for Black women, but she was a huge philanthropist. So Dr. Willis delves into these stories, and she teaches about different aspects of these heroes and folks that have become heroes because of her work.
Can you talk more about your efforts in this podcast season one and hopefully beyond to highlight African-American composers and performers in the opera and classical music world?
Okay, well, in this series, it's a 16-part series we're dealing with Monostatos from Magic Flute. We're going to deal with Asmin from the abduction from Seraglio, another Mozart opera. Again, Asmin was sort of an outcast in the opera. He was described as a Moor. We're going to deal with Otello by Verdi, but Shakespeare wrote this character who, you know, turned out to be a villain and murderous. And so we're going to deal with him, and we're going to deal with Aida, you know, Aida, who ended up being an Ethiopian slave. And so, you know, you have the Black slave, two Black slaves, you have a Black villain, you have a Black murderer. And so these tropes, you know, that take us back to the 16th century. Our podcast really just tries to shine, put a spotlight on them and not necessarily directly make ties to the, you know, to modern society, but just spotlight that. And so we know that it's there, and we look for ways of telling other stories. And that's why I'm pairing Sharon Willis alongside these great opera composers, because she tells stories of a different side of Black life. You know, Mr. Herndon, who born in Atlanta, he was born into slavery, but he became, you know, a very successful entrepreneur, founded an insurance company, became a millionaire in the early 20th century. She tells the story of an explorer named York, who was out with Lewis and Clark. And just these great stories, you know, Cicerita Jones, you know, who went to New England Conservatory back in the 19th century. You know, a few years ago, I told the story of Florence Price, who, you know, had been forgotten for the most part. I found a biographer who had been trying to get her research published on Florence Price, and she said, no one is interested in Florence Price. Her name was Ray Linda Brown. She passed away a few years ago. And I said, well, I'm interested and I'd love to tell her story. She shared notes with me and I created a 1-hour documentary on Florence Price. Now her music is being played around the country, you know, different parts of the world. I think an orchestra just won a Grammy for recording one of her piano concerto. So telling these stories, man, only really shows the richness of our country. You know, it shows that some of the brilliance that folks in our country have, and they've just been overlooked. So those are the stories that I'm interested in telling, because I think telling these stories about us will help to inspire some of us, some of our young kids who go to school and, you know, who will show up to hear these operas or to, you know, turn on the radio and hear some of these stories. They may hear themselves in some of these stories and, you know, pursue not necessarily music, but just something that they're passionate about.
Terrence, congratulations on the podcast, and thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You know, I love talking about this stuff. I'm so glad you invited me to have this conversation.
That's Terrence McKnight, weekday evening host for New York's all-classical music station, WQXR. We talked to him today about a new podcast he's hosting, just launched today. It's called Every Voice. It looks at Black representation in Western classical music.